I wish to say one thing, which I was asked to say by Thelma Gwynn Thurston, who is reasonably healthy and in reasonably good spirits in Chapel Hill. She wished for us a grand time at this 50th celebration. She also said that she knew Leon would be very proud to know that we were celebrating and that the society was in such good health. And I think also he would be very proud at the presentations that we've had on the program. We're grateful to Bruce and to Ann for many things at this meeting, but he certainly should be congratulated for not only contacting, but getting an agreement from our three living founders to appear at this meeting and share with us their perspectives on the founding of the society. Al Kurtz, who is not here, was planning to come and would be here were it not for an automobile accident very recently, which prevents him from traveling. We wish him well and wish he were able to join us. Despite appearances, I was not a charter member of Psychometric Society. My time with the society goes back for three quarters of the 50 years, not as long as Jack Carroll's affiliation, a wee bit longer than Torgerson and Bert Green, but I'm very honored to be here to introduce our participants and our panelists. It's a bit of a disadvantage when charged with setting the scene on this occasion not to have been a charter member of the Psychometric Society. It means that my information in introducing and making a very few remarks about the first years must be based upon public information. Indeed, I had to read Psychometrica to learn a little bit about the very first years. The organizational meeting, as I read in Psychometrica, was held in February of 1935, and affiliation with the APA was immediately established, and a meeting of the Psychometric Society was held in September of 1935 in conjunction with the American Psychological Association. The president of the society in 1935-36 was L.L. Thurston at the University of Chicago. The secretary was Paul Horst, then at Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati. The treasurer was Jack Dunlap at Fordham University in New York City. The chairman of the membership committee was John Stalnaker at Chicago. The editorial council consisted of Thurston, chairman, Horst and Al Kurtz, editors, Marion Richardson as managing editor. Now, all of us authors and potential authors know how influential an editorial board is. All of us board members know that there's not really much influence, but nevertheless, let me, for a couple of reasons, just read to you the names of the board of editors, the editorial board of Psychometrica, during its first year. Its first volume, first issue, appeared in March 1936. Both because I think it's appropriate to honor these people and because it illustrates a point. On the editorial board was Elmer A. Culler, an experimental psychologist who dealt with learning and psychophysical problems, particularly in vision. E. E. Cureton, whom we No. Jack Dunlap, Max Engelhart, J.P. Guilford, Harold Gullickson, Carl Holzinger, Paul Horst, Clark Hull, Truman Kelly, Al Kurtz, Quinn McNamara, Nicholas Reshevsky, mentioned earlier today, chairman of the Committee on Mathematical Biophysics at Chicago, Marion Richardson, Phil Roulon, Charles Spearman, William Stevenson, Sam A. Stauffer, Godfrey Thompson, L.L. Thurston, and S.S. Wilkes. Certainly a distinguished group to whom we owe a great deal. But the breadth of interest in that group is noteworthy. Also noteworthy is that the group included not only people in the United States, but also abroad. So that from its very inception, the society invited active participation from, in this case, several disciplines, and from a group of internationally renowned scientists. It is a real honor for me to introduce the two founders able to be here, and we've agreed that each will spend a few minutes reminiscing, then perhaps have the opportunity to challenge one another on the facts of the case, and we'll hope to have time for further discussion. Paul Horst received his PhD in Chicago in 1931. From 1930 to 1932, he was in Washington, D.C., employed by the U.S. Civil Service Commission. 1932, he moved to Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati, where he stayed until 1947, when he became a professor at the University of Washington and remained there until his retirement. I had the good fortune of being a first-year graduate student at the University of Washington in 1947, and along with other students, we were looking with some excitement to the knowing that Professor Horst was joining the faculty. Grace French, Bill Clemens, John Lyman, others in that group eagerly awaited the opportunity to take a course with Paul in the fall of 47. We got the impression that the course had been assigned by the chairman, and indeed maybe even the text had been assigned by the chairman. Paul arrived shortly before the fall semester began, and the course was one called Industrial Psychology. I'm sure the chairman knew that anyone who'd come from Procter & Gamble and had worked at the U.S. Civil Service Commission should, of course, teach the course in Industrial Psychology. We had a fairly slim text, I think, by Tippett.
Tiffin.
Joe Tiffin. Joe Tiffin, of course. All of us in that group were eager to be exposed to a student of Thurston who would bring us a new quantitative perspective on psychology. As the semester developed, we got the impression that the course provided a challenge to its instructor. We knew it provided a challenge to the students. It was a rather discussion course, and the students were reluctant to initiate discussion, and the instructor seemed somewhat reluctant as well. We were a bit puzzled. The second semester, the spring of 1948, the same professor offered a course in matrix algebra. The course was offered in his home in a Thurstonian tradition where a blackboard was installed, and it didn't seem like the same person. The enthusiasm, the depth and richness of the knowledge was very exciting for all of us. Let me simply ask Paul to share with us as the initiator of the idea of a psychometric society, his views of those days. Paul Horst.
I'm going to tell you first that I would like to speak some for Al Kurtz, because he couldn't be here, and I worked rather closely with him in the earlier years. Is that all right? Is that too close? Can you hear? However, I do want to say that in 1960, I think, we had our 25th anniversary meeting, and I and others who were there were given a plaque that stated we were the 6 founders of the Psychometric Society. And that's the first time I knew that now I still don't know how I happened to be designated a founder, and I still don't remember or recall a great many of the things that happened in the development of the society. I want to tell you how I feel about this by just a brief little story that Edwin Guthrie, some of you may know who Edwin Guthrie was. He was a professor at University of Washington for many years, and then he was made essentially executive vice president of the university all of a sudden. And people asked him how he liked it and what he was doing, what his job was. He said, well, he's like the fellow that was sitting on the end of the Edmonds Pier, a pier that runs out into the Pacific Ocean. And he said, you see all these seagulls flying around here? Well, I'm administering them. Now, when anybody says that I was a founder or a partial founder of the Psychometric Society, I feel about like that I was just administering seagulls at that time. I want to say a little, I think at this point, about Al Kurtz and his contribution to the society. Let's see my notes. And I'm not going to try to gloss over anything, because we were young, and I may say quite opportunistic in what we did. We wanted to start something. I'm going to say first that I'm not going to give you the account of the original systematic account of the society is given in Psychometrica in 1942 volume and the 1960 volume by Jack Dunlap, who did a better job than I could. And the what role I perceived myself as playing in the inception of it was given in the SCORE newsletter of Division 5 in a sort of swan song that I gave at the APA meeting several years ago in three sessions, or in three parts. It was published in three parts in SCORE. The first, I think, was in May of 84, which tries to explain how I was going to be a novelist, and how I ever got into all of this sort of thing. It was because Freud was very popular in the lay literature at that time, and so I got acquainted with Freud and learned some sort of pseudopsychology, and learned that it was pseudopsychology a little later. And then I learned that there was a lot of Tolman had just come back. Edward Chase Tolman had just come back from studying with Kurler and Kafka in Germany, and so he was trying to explain Gestalt psychology to us, and I got the feeling that this was very highly verbal, and I wasn't sure just how much meaning there was to all this stuff. And but I did get a course in psychophysics from Ernest Glenn Weaver, who later went to Princeton and became well known in Audition, and this got me sort of started. And then I hadn't mathematics except in high school, and all through college, and but that's all in those, and I'm not going to take any more time on that. I just wanted to tell you that you can read this in the news packages of the newsletter if you're interested, and if not, don't waste your time. Now, Kurtz and I were at the Civil Service Commission together, and I very much, I can't emphasize too much that we weren't interested in mathematical or statistical theory. We had jobs to be done, and but very soon we would run into problems that there just didn't seem to be any way of solving except by mathematical means. And this emphasized a distinction which I have noted throughout the years, that there's a sort of a gulf, a pretty deep chasm between people who have problems to solve and people who have solutions for problems, whether anybody wants them solved or not. But we had real problems, and so we wanted to publish too. Well, we couldn't. In those days, the only journal, psychological journal, remotely psychological, was the Journal of Ed Psych, and so we were both fairly affluent in those days, because in the midst of the Depression, we had got we had jobs. We got these jobs in the research division of the Civil Service Commission as P3s, professional threes, at $3,200 a year. That was really good money, so I thought maybe I could buy a journal. But I learned early that the only way to have freedom of the press was to own a press. And then you couldn't always.
Well, I learned that later. So we talked about starting a journal, and we got this idea of society. Well, we couldn't have cared less about the Psychometric Society or any other society, but we wanted somebody to buy the journal. So Kurtz, as I recall, and John can correct me if he has other ideas, but I think it was Kurtz's idea. Well, why not start a society? And so they'd have to buy the journal. So we did. That was, I think, Kurtz's first contribution, which turned out to be pretty good. Now the tail is kind of wagging the dog. His second idea was, society couldn't support the journal. So what do we do? We'll get it, sell it to libraries. Well, now, that's a funny thing. In those days, it wasn't hard to get libraries to subscribe to journals. I understand now it is. They don't have much money. But that was in the Depression. However, the journal was only $5 then, a year. But Kurt said, let's charge them double and give them two copies. And tell them that then they'd have an extra copy to bind at the end of the year. So that was, I think, his second contribution. The third contribution, these are not necessarily in order, was the rating sheet that he devised for reviewers to evaluate articles. And I don't know whether any of you have ever seen, some of you older ones must have seen that rating sheet. I'm sure Jack has seen it. And it was started out with couldn't be worse, it's all full of all kinds of errors and so on. Then it went up, can't afford to miss it, the best article in 20 years or something like that. Typically Kurtz, if you knew Kurtz. We didn't trust the old guard, and we didn't want people like E.L. Thorndike and people like that to submit articles and with their names on it, so they'd just be accepted because they're big names. So it was his idea to try to remove all identifying information of the author. Other periodicals have adopted that practice since, and I've always regretted it, because every time I get a manuscript, I wonder who wrote it. I'll give you a trick. You look at the bibliography and see who has the most references, So that's how you do it. And you couldn't cross out the references, you know, so you can beat the editor that way. Another contribution of Kurtz was that he knew Jack Dunlap very well before we went to the Civil Service Commission. Jack Dunlap was at that time editor of the Journal of Ed Psych, and he had written a book of nomographs, equations, notations, published by World Book Company, and had a rather close personal relationship with Dunlap. And so Dunlap was brought in then as in helping to get the journal started. That I always thought was an important contribution, because I don't think, well, somebody else would have done it if we hadn't, or if Dunlap hadn't, but he was very influential in getting the thing started. He also helped. We decided that I don't think either of us knew much about constitutions of societies, but we decided that it would make a better impression on prospective members if there were a society with a constitution. So we patterned it after pretty much after the APA, and got it worked up, and then I think Thurston and Richardson and Stoniker, who were a little more sophisticated than we, polished it up. But that was Kurtz's idea too, that we have a constitution. I always think one of Kurtz's best ideas was to have in the journal a department which he called, in his very earthy way, a department of half-baked ideas. The idea was, it wasn't the bad idea, but the thing didn't have to be polished, it didn't have to be long, and you could establish priority, you know, how all this professional jealousy among writers, how they want to be the first. And you could do that, sort of establish your priority in this half-baked ideas department. That never got off the ground, really, until Bert Green introduced the notes and comments department. And I thought that when he did that, that really validated Kurtz's original idea. So that was in 1973, much, much later. I'm not going to tell you much more of what I did, except a rather interesting experience. Kurtz and I both left the civil service, I a little sooner than Kurtz, and went to Procter & Gamble. Marion Richardson of Cuda Richardson Reliability Formulas had been at Procter & Gamble. He wanted to go back to Chicago to take his PhD with Thurston, and so he recommended me for the job there. We'd both been students of Thurston, he was kind of a liaison then between Chicago and Procter & Gamble. We didn't know how to get this thing started, and I happened to have a friend in the advertising department of Procter & Gamble whose sister was an art student at the University of Cincinnati, and so Kurtz and I worked up the idea that we'd run a contest, offer a contest. Had a little sort of a popular resume of the kind of thing we wanted to publish, and offer a prize for the best cover. You would be amazed. We got about 30 ideas of covers. Very colorful, very imaginative, and I think we paid $30 for the prize, and I don't remember what took the prize. Nobody would ever have put any of those on the face of the journal, but I still think that it was a good idea to arouse interest in it, because Thurston, of course, he none of those appealed to him, and we just said, what do you think would be a good cover? And so far as I know, Thurston designed the cover. But the interesting thing was that my Procter & Gamble friend, who was involved in this, said he knew we were trying to start something and like this, and he said he felt this was pretty silly, he said that he would like to have, he was making a collection of first and last issues of journals, and he would like to have the first issue and also the last. Well, I don't know whatever became of him. The last issue I know of is March 9, 1985, and Evo tells me now that the June issue is soon out, and I hope this won't be the last one. The first issue. Now, Bruce raised some questions, and I just say I'm running way.
No, we can't let you stop without presenting the issue.
The first issue. It's kind of interesting because I'll just read you the table of contents. Some of you certainly know what it is. The first article was Mathematical Biophysics and Psychology by Nicholas Reshevsky. And this, I think, is interesting because this was kind of, I think, the start of math, the math model psychologist. Then there was Simplified Calculation of Principal Components by Harold Hotelling. He had already written his 1933 article, Principal Components article. Then the next one, The Relationship Between Degree of Original Learning and Degree of Transfer, which was a follow-up on his article, I believe published in 1933 in one of Murchison's journals, and was an attempt to put in mathematical form Thorndike's law of effect, and actually was a sort of an elaboration of Thurston's earlier work of several years, where he had developed his rational equations to the learning curve. Then a very practical article by Albert Kurtz, The Use of the Doolittle Method in Obtaining Related Multiple Correlation Coefficients. Another one, Obtaining a Composite Measure from a Number of Different Measures of the Same Attribute by Paul Horst. And this was nothing more than Hotelling's principal axis method, which turned out to be Pearson's, and I guess before that the astronomers on the three-body problem, I've been told. But anyway, that's the first time a psychologist knew anything about it, I believe. Then was Thurston's Bounding Hyperplanes of a Configuration of Traits, and Notes on the Rationale of Item Analysis. And very interestingly, On the Use of Mathematics in Psychological Theory by J.F. Brown, which was, I think J.F. Brown was a student of Kurt Levine, and it was a topological sort of thing which kind of foreshadowed the non-metric scaling work and so on. I guess maybe I better stop, should I? I just go on.
Paul will pause in his remarks. While Paul and Al Kurtz were initiating this idea to acquire and own a journal in Cincinnati, they recognized that they needed very badly the support of the Chicago people, particularly Mr. Thurston. And is that right? And their friends at Chicago, primarily Marion Richardson and John Stalnaker, represent then the Chicago connection that they pressed into coordinated action with them in order to get Thurston's cooperation. John Stalnaker was a measurement examiner at the University of Chicago from 1931 to 1936, moved in 36 to become a professor at Princeton, where he stayed until 1945, and I learned over dinner that he directed at that time the Army-Navy college examination program. Among other people that he brought to assist him were Henry Chauncey and Harold Gullickson, who, when he left Princeton to go to Stanford as a professor in 1945, stayed on, and soon thereafter established something called the Educational Testing Service. John stayed at Stanford until 1949. Indeed, I knew him when I came as a student from the University of Washington to Stanford, or at least was acquainted at that time. Then spent 6 years as research director of the Association of American Medical Colleges. And during these last years, John developed some ideas that the nation needed a way to emphasize the importance of scholarly endeavor among its high school students, and took the initiative and essentially developed the idea, which became the National Merit Scholarship Program. John served as the president of the National Merit Scholarship Corporation then from 1955 until his retirement. So we now hear the perspective from the Chicago connection, John.
A pleasure to be here, I assure you. As I thought about this meeting, I was reminded of a song of long ago called "Oh Yes, I Remember It Well." This was in the musical comedy Gigi, and two oldsters meet after a long interval and recall a rendezvous they had many years ago. And Maurice Chevalier says, regarding this rendezvous, "I can remember everything, just as if it were yesterday." And then he makes a fundamental error. He goes on to prove his point by recalling the details. He says, "We dined at 9. And Hermione Gingo, or his partner, says, "No, it was 8. He says, "It was a dazzling April moon," only to be reminded that the month was June and there was no moon that night. She was beautiful in her gown of gold, and she said she was dressed in blue. He recalls the tenor singing Russian songs, and she says, "No, it was a baritone, and the songs were from sunny Spain." But the one thing that they do remember and agree on was that they had a wonderful evening they'll never forget. Now, to bring this down to terms here, what I remember about the founding of the Psychometric Society is that we had an interesting and an exciting time. don't press me for details. But my part took place over 50 years ago, and I do not remember the details as if they were yesterday. One advantage I have in speaking here is that no one here present was present at the Chicago meetings in which I took part. Harold Gullickson might have been in on some of them, and I took advantage of telephoning him just a few nights ago and spent about an hour talking to him about the old days and got his promise that he would not be here tonight, which gives me the opportunity to speak freely and authoritatively on what took place there. Now, the University of Chicago 50 years ago was an exciting place to be. It was a place in intellectual ferment, something you don't find in many universities very often. Hutchins had decided that there should be a board of examiners with Thurston as the chief examiner. This opening gave Thurston the opportunity to employ some of his graduate students, of whom I was one. Thurston was working on his applications of mathematics to psychological matters, primary mental abilities, factor analysis, attitude measurements, among other things. As one of the examiners, I was busy with the humanities faculty that was assigned to me. The humanities faculty consisted of scholars and delightful individuals who gave me the best education I have ever had. But Thurston and we followers of his met periodically at the Quadrangle Club to discuss our problems. At one of these meetings, the matter of a journal for the sort of mathematical writing that Thurston and a few others were doing came up. Paul Horst, who was at Procter & Gamble, had been working on this idea for some time and had passed the notion along to Thurston, who was eager to move it forward. Our discussions were over a long period of time, and they were not smooth and progressive. There were many discussions and much debate and much disagreement. Now, I have no doubt that discussions of this same nature were going on with Horst and Kurtz and others at the same time, and doubtless a good deal of correspondence. But I was not privy to most of that. And I want to avoid the tendency here, which is common in these things, to reconstruct the past to fit into an orderly, logical, systematic pattern leading to an ideal solution. It wasn't that way at all. Much went on. Many ideas were discarded. There were violent disagreements, and there were discouragements. I also think that luck and chance play much more a part in these organizational efforts than it is given credit for. Harold Gullickson, for example, told me in the recent conversation I had with him that he opposed the development of Psychometrica. He felt, as he does today, that the need is not so much for a journal as it is for some ideas that are worth publishing. And that he would like to see more polished manuscripts and thinks there's no lack of places to publish them. That may account for his not being one of the founders. I do not remember. He came in with a few others soon enough to lend money to get the journal started. And how those of us who gave the small amount of money we did, I don't remember what it was, lent it.
$100 a piece.
$100 a piece. I don't know where in the world we got it. These were very hard times. But in any case, we gave $100 a piece and got the to help get the journal started. Now, within the Chicago group, I was the closest at that time, to get personal here, to Marion Richardson and to Thurston. Marion had been at Procter & Gamble along with Horst and Kurtz. And when I got to know him, he was living in Chicago. Now, I trust you people are properly impressed with the role that Procter & Gamble played in all this. I always use Ivory soap, and I hope that you will be equally faithful to Procter & Gamble, who did so much to hire psychometricians of the quality that they did in the work that they were doing, and I think it has probably paid off for them. In these early days in Chicago, I was a bachelor living alone about a block away from Richardson, who was married. Problems at home may have caused him to seek frequent refuge in my apartment. A small portable pinball machine was a mindless source of diversion for us. That and drinking quantities of red wine. We must have had some serious moments for serious discussions of the newly planned journal, and we wrote three papers together, which appeared in print before Psychometric existed. In 1923, I married and moved, and Richardson eventually was divorced. We remained close friends and frequently met in Washington throughout the war years. Now, Harold Gulickson then came along in the examiner's office after Richardson, and I got to know him equally well, and finally got him, as is suggested here, to join me in Princeton during the war years, where he did some applications of his theoretical psychometric knowledge to some very practical problems in the war activities. And I was very interested to have him tell me that those years that he spent doing that were the most pleasurable years of his professional life. Both Richardson and Gulickson played an active role in the editing of Psychometrica in the early days and were a strong influence in it, although, as I say, Gulickson was not among the founders. Going back to Paul's horse about not knowing exactly why the six were done, this is where I think a certain amount of luck journal and would make it into a journal of giving test norms and test results, which was the last thing that he wanted. In other words, he really didn't trust the mass of psychologists and the thought that they might join the society, take over the journal, and determine its editorial program was repugnant to him, thoroughly repugnant to him. I wonder in this connection what he would think of the American Psychological Association recently spending millions of dollars to buy Psychology Today with the absurd thought that those people have enough business judgment and know-how to run a journal like that and make it a financial success. This is what he was worried about. In any case, after much falderal, and I personally was involved, we set up a psychometric corporation apart from the society. This was to publish and control and protect the editorial policy of the journal. In addition to the founders of the society, the additional members of Gulickson and Guilford signed the incorporations for the Psychometric Corporation. A few carefully selected members were later added, and initially we were the guardians to assure that Psychometrica would publish material reflecting the interests of the dominant members of the founders. Eventually, the corporation was dissolved, again with much paperwork, and I don't think really served any useful purpose. From my point of view, the particular six of us who were the founders of the society got together primarily because of Thurston. Horst had the idea and did most of the groundwork. Thurston had the prestige, he had the contacts, and he had the staff to get the thing done. Richardson, Horst, and Kurtz, able psychometricians, knew each other through their war work at Procter & Gamble. Dunlap was brought in because of his abilities and experience in running a journal. We have never been a closely knit group, personally or professionally, each going his own way and doing his own thing. The war years influenced the careers of many of us, for better or worse. All of us seemed to go into applications. Hearst, Kurtz, and Horst went into helping Procter & Gamble sell their products better. Richardson went into consulting, in the sort of thing where you do anything for anybody that will pay you enough. And I entered into a number of enterprises connected with measurement. I know little of Dunlap's professional life in the later years, But Thurston was the only one of these six who were what I would call, from the start and throughout, a pure academic, which is rather interesting. I don't know if it means anything. Has the journal lived up to our expectations, I was asked. Well, speaking for myself, anything that's gone on for 50 years must be meeting some need and must be doing some good. Is it making psychology a more rational science? I don't know, but I think that it may be nudging it in that direction. It's got an awful lot more pushing to do. The tendency of academic journals is to become too narrow, and I am not sufficiently familiar with the current journal to know to what extent that is true of it, but and looking over the papers that were published here today that have been presented here at these meetings, I would not feel that that is a criticism that should be leveled. In any case, it seems to me that the organization is now in good hands, and I hope that in the next 50 years you'll make it a very much better organization and journal than it is today. Thank you.
There undoubtedly is a degree of uncertainty as to whether the moon was full in Chicago at the inception of the society, but there's no question but what the gentleman from whom we've heard had an extremely important role in establishing the society and the journal, and we're grateful for their sharing of those experiences. I wonder if members of the audience would like to ask a question of either of the panelists about anything that was said or any aspect of the history that yes, sir.
I've always wondered about the second issue of the first volume of Psychometrica, because the first volume of Psychometrica has two page ones, two page twos, two page threes, and so on, because the second issue starts with page one. Then the third issue is numbered as if the second issue had been numbered appropriately. And I'm always wondering about how that happened.
That was all taken care of up at Chicago, so I think I...
Paul was strong in the editorial staff at that moment, and he was responsible for all of those details.
As a matter of fact, you'll notice if you look at the inside covers on the first issue that Horst and Kurtz were called editors and Richardson managing editor. A managing editor, managing meant that he was responsible for everything that happened. So,
I understand there was a major controversy between Harold Rotelli and Thurston. Can you clarify some of the issues?
Well, I can certainly discuss them. whether I can clarify them this really goes back, you know, to there was Spearman's two-factor theory and the tetrad equations. Well, of course, we all know now that all those tetrad equations meant was that if you put the right elements in the diagonal of the correlation matrix, that you had a rank one matrix. I mean, Spearman didn't know what rank was. And, of course, we soon learned, I mean, even Spearman, I think, took up group factors, and Kelly. Kelly got a little more sophisticated, and I remember very, very clearly, I was walking with Thurston past the old Drexel Avenue apartment building that was a psychology building at that time. I had already been with Procter & Gamble, but I'd get up to see Thurston every once in a while, and say, he said, "Horst, we've got to do something about this
factor analysis, or this factor theory of two-factor theory, of general factor theory of Spearman. And he said, we, and I felt very flattered because I didn't, hadn't the remotest idea what I could do about it. But anyway, he then generalized, as you well know, he generalized Spearman's two-factor theory to his multiple factor analysis, which was just extending the rank one to then about the same time, Hotelling. Well, Hotelling had already come out in 1933 with his principal components analysis in the Journal of Ed Psych. Now, then a controversy arose between there was Thurstone, Hotelling, Holzinger, and I think Clark Hull was also in this. There was a Unitary Traits Committee, and they were all supposed to be doing something about the unitary traits of intelligence. And I don't remember who was paying for things at that time. They didn't pay very much, I know that. But some little foundation, maybe it was Carnegie, it could have been. But anyway, I finally decided they didn't know what they were arguing about because Thurstone, it was a whole specificity versus, Hotelling wanted to account for all the variants and a minimum with a minimum number of factors. And Thurston came at it just from entirely the other direction, where there were most of it was specific factors, and of course Hotelling was a mathematical statistician. He wasn't a psychologist at all, but we all revered him because he was about the only person in those days who knew any mathematics that would interact with psychologists, and especially with Jack Dunlap, who was also Hotelling was at Columbia at that time, and Jack Dunlap was at, I think he was at Fordham then, so they were both in New York, and so Jack would published Hotelling's articles, but. Well, I think I could tell a little more. You're quite right. There was somewhat more than just friendly disagreement on this issue, and I think it's safe to say that because Hotelling didn't know enough psychology and. Thurstone didn't know enough mathematics. Thurstone would be the last, I think, to say that he was a mathematician. He was trained as an engineer. Now, I don't know whether this throws any light on it, on the issue, but...
Let me add a footnote. In 1952, Thurston moved from Chicago upon his retirement to Chapel Hill, where Hotelling was then a full professor, and by that time, any antagonism between the two of them was clearly dissipated. Hotelling was a strong supporter of Thurston's coming, and they had a good relationship. Yeah. Rolf Bargmann came to work with Thurston and ended up taking his PhD with Hotelling. Jack Carroll talked to Mrs. Hotelling within the last couple of weeks, reminiscing about that particular period. When Thurston and Hotelling were exchanging each other's work and kind notes, and
Hotelling told me he wasn't really sure. He told me this in about 54. He wasn't really sure whether it had been best to affiliate with the psychology department, because Hotelling had asked him to affiliate with statistics, and Gertrude Cox had asked him to affiliate with the two-campus institute. It was, I think, the misunderstanding about multiple group factor analysis, yeah, on the one hand, and principal components, mm-hmm, the difference between communality and total variance, mm-hmm, that led to the initial conflict.
Well, that's not entirely resolved even yet, you know.
Any other question, comment? Yeah.
Yeah, somehow I happen to find myself perusing an issue of Psychometrica from 1944. Don't ask me why. But I noticed in there a report of a committee that was chaired by Harold Gillickson. And the committee that put together the report was recommending that the Psychometric Society not be merged with APA. And there was no contextual information saying where that came from or what brought that question on.
I think you raised that question in a letter to me, this was quite an issue at the time. We really did need the APA at that time for support, because for a long time Psychometric Society meetings and APA meetings were held together. And as a matter of fact, Donald Patterson of Minnesota was very helpful in getting the society organized and giving support. It was a lot easier in those days for any one individual to exert influence in the APA than it is now. I mean, now it's just a huge amorphous sort of thing, and no one person can do anything. But he engineered that affiliation at that time. Now, I don't recall that notice that you refer to, Bruce, because it was affiliated. I don't know what affiliation consisted of in those days. I know that later on, you see, there was no Division 5. The divisional structure of APA didn't take place until after World War II. And Division 5 was organized, and then Division 5 and Psychometric Society used to hold joint meetings. And I remember I was still a member of the Psychometric Corporation. This was long before it was disbanded. And I was, I think if there had been a Division 5 at that time or earlier or something to take care of the quantitative interests of the younger, some of the younger psychologists, I don't know whether the Psychometric Society would ever have been organized, but I said at that meeting that as far as I was concerned, I think it might be a good thing for the Psychometric Society just to merge with Division 5 and not be an independent entity. And it was at once pointed out to me that that couldn't be done anymore because the membership of Psychometric Society consisted of many persons who weren't eligible for membership in APA and had no reason for wanting to be members, and were extremely valuable members
of the society. Well, of course, this sort of thing then has gone on, you know. And this,
let me ask John if he'd care to comment on Bruce's question.
Well, I just give you some general impressions now, not with specifics. But Thurston was not anxious to become totally connected with APA. He wanted a separation. He wanted the society to be able to include people who were not members of APA. And he did not want the dominant, he was afraid of the dominant structure of APA as coming in and influencing. Now, there was need for help in the membership. There was need of organizational things and all. I don't minimize any of those things you said. But Thurston, in my memory, very clearly was negative to being a part of the APA, a regular division of the APA, and he did not want it.
I think that I would think that would be true.
Jack.
I might add a little. In about 1952, I was secretary of the Psychometric Society, and at that time, if I remember correctly, Raymond Cattell was trying to change the organization or get it more interested in the sort of thing Cattell was doing. And I remember, though, that I was almost given instructions as secretary to have nothing to do with the new multivariate behavioral of multivariate society. So it simply points up the fact that the Psychometric Society has always been very jealous of its own integrity.
Yes. Yes.
I'm sure that the panelists would welcome discussions with any individuals that would like to carry on this this interesting conversation. Let us again thank them warmly for their sharing these ideas. I really appreciated this. I learned more tonight than I did in a whole year.
I wouldn't mind
really.
Well,
yeah.
The problem is one thing.
If the day is young,
I'll check with you. I don't want to do it. I don't want to think of very much.
All right.
I thank you also for what you did tonight. So useful to learn about the old days.
The mere fact that Harold was never president of the Psychometric Society
leads me to believe
that there may have been a slight undercurrent.
Yes. Yeah, he was on the
leads me to believe that maybe it wasn't all this rosy. But I'm not sure.
I sort of remember the
one.
But
maybe.
Yeah.